Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast12. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast12. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
I got flying cake pans.
I got crazy horses. Wah! Wah!
Date fight!
Hello, and welcome to Date Fight. It's the podcast where we take two moments that occurred on this day in history and pitch them against each other.
Yes, we do. He's Jake Yap. I'm Nat Tapley. And together, we have trolled through the zoo of history to find the two fightingiest and most interesting animals to make them battle in a possibly illegal, garage-based way for your love.
And do you know what we...
And entertainment.
And do you know what we realised the most fightingiest animal was? Humans.
What was
man.
It?
Actually man. Like, specifically... Man, as in men. Yeah. Oh, mate. It's just so depressing.
Maybe the most fightingest animal was in our hearts all along. I'm going to take you to... Have we explained it enough? Doesn't matter. Moving on.
Yeah, it's fine.
I'm going to take you to the 23rd of January, 1795. We don't usually do naval battles, but this is a good naval battle. It was the capture of the Dutch fleet at Den Helder. So deep in the night of the 23rd of January, 1795, the French, who, lest we forget, were about to get into 20 years of fighting everybody under Napoleon, but he wasn't in charge yet, the French captured the entire Dutch fleet at Den Helder. The 14 Dutch ships and 850 guns were in the sea between the port of Den Helder and the island of Texel. And they were all taken without a shot being fired.
Wow.
How many ships do you reckon it took the French to do that, Jake?
Well, 14 ships that they took, I'm going to say 12.
Zero.
What?
Zero ships. They used no ships, but only horses.
That's incredible. How do you... Wow, so...
It's one of the few examples we have.
I think I've got it.
Yes.
They got
yes.
a massive lorry full of horses and tipped them into the harbour, thereby stranding the fleet.
Well, think of what time of year it is.
A horrific horse dam.
Oh, well, the Dutch would have liked that, I'm sure. Dutch make a dam out of anything, don't they? They can't see anything without wanting to damn it. No, you have to think what time of year it was to work out how they did it.
It was frozen.
It was frozen indeed. And this is one of the few examples we have of a cavalry versus naval battle. And what they did was they crept up in the dead of night, put tiny little horseshoes on their horses' feet so the Dutch wouldn't hear them clopping over the ice.
Horse slippers,
and then crept up, which I imagine they're doing like Bullseye from Toy Story.
Yeah, and with accompanied by pizzicato strings.
And they got there, and the Dutch went, "Oh no, you have captured us all!" In whatever voice the Dutch had.
I wasn't going to say.
It started okay, then it went Italian halfway through the second sentence. I'm like, all right, let's leave it. Let's not go back and do anything about that. Just leave it in.
I can't do Dutch. I feel like there's lots of people who I judge.
People tend to...
As being inferior to me. That's a terrible thing to say, but they can all do Dutch accents.
But they just do sort of quite sensible ones with S's rather than S's, don't they? That's the typical Dutch.
Yeah.
That's what people go for. It's not really... showing any insight into the Dutch mind. It's just copying what was on the Grolsch advert in the late 90s.
It's just like a slightly kinked Sean Connery, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So the French crept up in there with their horse slippers. The ice didn't break and there were no French casualties. At least that's how the French tell it. The Dutch historians tend to say that they'd already surrendered and two hussars came over on horses and collected their official surrender, but the French love to claim they crept up in their lovely horse slippers overnight and captured the entire Dutch fleet on the 23rd of January, 1795.
That's deeply impressive, if only for the pizzicato and the slippers. I'm going to take you back to the 23rd of January, 1546, and having published not a word for 11 years, François Rabelais publishes the Tiers Livre, the third book, which was his sequel to Gargantua and Pantagruel. Now, the first two books, I don't know if you're... Are you familiar with them?
Of Gargantua and Pantagruel?
Yeah.
Isn't that one with the giant that eats its own poo at one point?
They're stupendous sounding books.
It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So they're about a giant, Gargantua.
Yeah.
And talk about nominative determinism. Anyway, he's born. As a baby, he wears a yard-long codpiece.
Does he, indeed?
Causing three nurses to fight over him. And he grows up and basically spends a lot of his sort of young adulthood just drowning thousands upon thousands of people in urine.
Lovely.
So attention then moves on to an absolute danger when it comes to Renaissance bands called Panurge.
Yep.
And there's a battle, and a guy called Epistemon, who's decapitated, recovers when Panurge sews his head back onto his body.
Yay!
But he can report that the souls in hell, he can tell you what hell is like. Basically, you just don't get very good pay and the jobs aren't very good. But that's as bad as it
it's
gets.
It's much like France now I think of it. Much like it is here. And every Englishman would agree.
Yeah, good work hours though. And then another battle happens, but that gets missed by the narrator because he's exploring the civilization in Pantagruel's mouth at the time. So with bonkers stuff like that, where do you go from there? The third book, I'll say, is pretty meh. What happens is Panurge is now financially solvent and stops wearing his long codpiece and starts looking for advice about who to marry.
That's lowered the stakes somewhat.
Yeah. He consults with various counsellors, the Sibyl of Panzoust, the mute called Goat Nose, and the old poet Ramina Grobis, Friar John, a group of doctors and lawyers, and a fool. And they all say, if you marry, your wife will cheat on you, and she'll beat you, and she'll rob you. But he decides to do it anyway.
Oh, dear. I like the idea that they're saying, that mute, does he mind being called Goat Nose? Well, he hasn't said anything about it.
No.
He's fine with it.
It then says, in a brief interlude, Pantagruel defends Judge Brindlegoose, who's pronounced sentence by rolling dice for 40 years, on the grounds that he's an old idiot and is therefore favoured by fortune. Then, trying to settle the question of marriage, Pantagruel and Panurge take a sea voyage to consult the Oracle of Bacbouc, Divine Bottle, and their ship is well provisioned with the phallic herb Pantagruelion.
Ooh, lovely.
Can I just take you through book four? Because that's when it really comes to a head.
I'm on the edge of my seat. Please do.
The group sails to East Asia and buys many exotic animals. Panurge quarrels with the sheep merchant Ding Dong and takes his revenge by drowning him and his flock. Oh. They pass by the islands of the...
Why do you take revenge on the flock? You argue with the shepherd, you don't then get right. This'll learn you. After you're done, I'm going to drown all those sheep as well. There's no point in taking revenge on the flock.
And do you know what you sound like? You sound like a vegan. They pass by the islands of the bailiffs, whose peasants charge to be beaten. Then there's a storm, they slay a sea monster, and a giant dies, and then they arrive at Wild Island, where the half-sausage inhabitants mistake Pantagruel for their enemy and attack. The battle is stopped by a divine-winged pig who excretes mustard on the battlefield. Then they go to Ruach, where people eat air, to Pope Figland, where a farmer and his wife outwit the devil. And then they sail through a cloud of frozen words and sounds and come to an island that worships Gaster, the god of food. And the book ends when Pantagruel fires a salute at the island of the muses and Panurge befouls himself for fear of the sound and of the celebrated cat Rodilardus.
I like it. I'll give you 2 million for the rights.
I mean, what free writing?
Yeah.
500 years ago.
That's brilliant. Who do you see in the lead?
Yeah, I think this screams Adam Sandler vehicle to me.
Jason Statham. Wow, amazing. Did it go on after that, or was it just the four books?
There was a fifth book, but it's not really of his style. Do you know what it is? It's epistolary. They think largely kind of reconstructed by the publisher. And most of it is lists of a name of something. I can't remember.
Rabelais' unpaid bills.
The fifth book has some fun stuff. So there's an island called Tool Island.
Does it have a winged pig that
excretes mustard on a battlefield?
Over a battlefield?
No, yeah. No. But it's got people who live on an island called Tool Island, and they're so fat that they have to slit their skin to let the fat just trickle out. But he invented hundreds of new words in the text, and some of them have become part of the French language.
Oh.
Don't ask me which ones.
Rabelaisian.
Yeah, that'll do.
Yeah. Right, let's do the birthdays. Happy birthday to John Hancock, the founding father whose extravagant signature on the Declaration of Independence led to his name being a byword for signatures everywhere. Put your John Hancock right there, they said to John Hancock, and he did.
Oh, okay, that explains the court case.
Well, that is where it's from. His extravagant signature is why a signature is a John Hancock.
Yeah, but when someone told me to put my John Hancock there...
Which did you do first, hand or...?
They had to shut down the whole branch of NatWest.
Happy birthday to Django Reinhardt, who was the best at something that sounds awful. I mean, jazz guitar sounds like possibly the worst time you can have, but it's not, and he does it. It's okay. That's Django Reinhardt.
Was he one of those ones with nine fingers? He was, wasn't he?
He's got loads of fingers, isn't he? He's off too few. Is it too few or too many?
Nine. I think he had nine.
Which is too few?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
Happy birthday to the Danish robot stout vendor, Rutger Hauer.
Just to let you know that putting Django Reinhardt into a search engine, the first suggestion that comes up for a search is Django Reinhardt fingers. And I'm hoping that's not a verb.
Yeah, precisely. Try putting in other names after it and see what comes up.
He only had two good fingers on his left hand.
What? So he can only play, like, really simple chords, but...
That would explain his kind of block chording stuff, right?
Yeah, as long as you've got two that function, you're all right, aren't you?
Yeah, so he was in a fire when he was 18.
Oh, wow.
And he lived in a gypsy caravan, so obviously it was all made of wood, and... His common law wife, Bella, was making artificial flowers out of paper and celluloid, which was really, really flammable.
Ooh.
And he knocked over a candle and the flowers ignited and it was engulfed in flames.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. That's the kind of information someone who brought the person up in the podcast should have looked up, really. Amazing.
The doctor wanted to amputate his right leg, but he said, no, I'm going to go to a nursing home, and he got better.
Wow.
But the two smallest fingers on his left hand, crucial for fretboard work, were paralysed. So he invented his own method of playing.
Amazing. Yes, you can see when you watch him play, he reaches all the way over with sort of the top of his hand.
Yeah.
Happy death day to Isabella, the Queen of Armenia. She was the Queen Regnant of Cilicia, and Constantine of Barbaron was appointed as her guardian. He arranged her marriage to Prince Philip. Yes, he is that old. The son of Bohemond IV of Antioch. But when he arrived, Prince Philip despoiled the palace and stole the crown and sent it off. So they put him in prison.
Was there mustard? Did he despoil it with mustard? Or?
Imagine there was mustard everywhere. not Dijon, grain mustard.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
At which point, Constantine of Barbaron tried to marry Isabella off to his own son, Hethun, in 1266. She married him, but refused to ever consummate the marriage. She died, having heard voices from heaven a few years later. That's Isabella, Queen of Armenia, who died on this day in the 13th century. Happy death day to Edvard Munch, whose The Scream was the inspiration for Home Alone. And there are so many great artists today. You could just do great artists. And so I've gone for happy death day to Gordon Kay, the cycloptic star of Allo Allo, which I sorted because my wife went on tour with him in 2000, I think. And she has a lot of very filthy Gordon Kay stories, which I'll tell you all in person, but not on a recorded medium.
We need to do a meet-up.
Yeah. The tour included Gordon Kay, Vicky Michelle, Ken Morley and Carol Harrison doing a farce called Business Affairs. And, yeah, what goes on tour stays on tour, but I will whisper it in your ear if we're ever in the same vicinity.
Perfect. I'm going to take you to the 23rd of January 1957, but I'm going to scoot 20 years earlier than that.
Oh.
So a very distant cousin of John Wayne. A guy called Walter Frederick Morrison.
Yes, it was the Morrison family.
Is mucking about in the garden with his girlfriend. Chucking a popcorn can lid about.
Oh, dear. This never ends well.
And the trouble is, it got a bit dented, and so they were like, well, what can we chuck at each other now? I know, cake pans.
Mm.
And then they went to the beach in Santa Monica, now married, Walter Frederick Morrison and his wife, Lucille Eleanor Lunay. They were on the beach in Santa Monica and chucking their cake pan around, and someone said, that looks like a lot of fun. I'll give you 25 cents for that cake pan.
Mm-hmm.
And Morrison said in an interview, that got the wheels turning because you could buy a cake pan for 5 cents. And if people on the beach were willing to pay a quarter for it, well, there was a business.
Yeah.
So they developed the flying cake pans business on the beaches of Los Angeles. What should we call it?
Flying Morrison's cake pans. Flying cake pans.
Now, the thing was,
the finest in flying cake pans. Mm.
This was just the beginning, because during the Second World War, Morrison learned all about aerodynamics flying a P-47 Thunderbolt in Italy. Not quite enough, because he was shot down and was a prisoner of war for 48 days.
Had a lot of time to think then.
Well, quite. And time passed by. And in 1946, he sketched out a design, because if there's one thing this guy knew, it was good names.
Mm.
For the Whirlaway. The Whirlaway. The world's first flying disc.
Hmm.
And then a guy came along called Warren Francione,
mm-hmm,
and paid him for, paid to get the design molded in plastic. And they called it not the Whirlaway, but the Flying Saucer. And no one bought it.
No.
And they parted company. But then the Pluto Platter got developed.
Ooh.
By Fred and his wife Lucille. And this became the archetype of all modern flying discs. And on January the 23rd, this very day in 1957, they sold the rights for the Pluto Platter to the Wham-O Toy Company.
I'd love to have a toy company in the mid-20th century. The names were incredible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 6 months later, they started calling it a Frisbee.
Oh, where did that name come from? I mean, it's quite a jump from Pluto Platter. Well, I can see where Pluto Platter comes from, but Frisbee.
Yeah, well, interestingly, it was college students in the Northeast just started calling it a Frisbee as a nickname.
Ooh.
And they were like, yeah, I think we'll go with that. And he carried on developing products for Wham-O, but nothing was as good.
Is it other discs?
Yeah, other things.
It's the roller. It's the Raging Roller. You can roll it. You can leave it on the floor.
The Saturn Circle. No, he didn't. No.
The Neptune Noose.
And Fred and Lou divorced in 1969. Then remarried in 1971.
Oh, that's nice.
But then divorced again.
Oh, that's not nice.
So that was that. But what a ride, eh?
Wow.
What a ride.
Just think, if he'd thought a bit harder, he could have come up with Morrison's.
Who sell Frisbees?
Do they?
No,
let's check.
Who goes to Morrison's? No.
I'm going to take you to the 23rd of January, 1571, and the opening of the Royal Exchange in London, which was the first purpose-built commercial building in Britain. Previously, if you wanted to see a cobbler, you had to go to a cobbler shop. If you wanted spice, you had to go to a spice merchant shop. And if you wanted syphilis, you could go to a knocking shop. But there were no purpose-built buildings where groups of merchants would get together, which also included offices and things. Stockbrokers, by the way, were not allowed in when it opened because their manners were too rude. So they had to sell stocks from Jonathan's Coffee House elsewhere in London. The original building burnt down in 1666. The second building burnt down in 1838. But rather than taking this as a sign that maybe, you know, they shouldn't have a Royal Exchange, it was rebuilt. Lloyd's Insurance was based there originally before they went to South Sea House. The coronation of every new monarch is announced on the steps of the Royal Exchange, which is a bit odd. I mean, I think...
Yeah.
Announce it in the newspapers, but don't go to Britain's first, essentially the first shopping centre, like the prototype for Bluewater, to announce it.
Westfield, Buckingham.
Yeah. Nowadays, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, you can hear soulful singer Dee and her band, the finely groomed The Gents. and I think if your big selling point of your band is how they're grooming, maybe you should look at getting a better band. I don't know. I may be being very unfair to The Gents. It goes on to say...
love The Gents.
They will be luring guests with their mellow acoustics of old-school R&B, jazz and blues.
I am so there.
So The Gents... Yeah, let's go listen to The Gents by sitting in the open courtyard of the Royal Exchange, eating... This is what they suggest eating. Crepe Suzette.
Oh.
Doused in Fortnum's gin... pineapple and honey syrup, maraschino, strawberry ice cream, and black olive.
Oh.
Topped
with
soda water.
Oh.
Yeah, until I got to black olive and soda water, I imagine most
people decided that fizzy brine was the way forward?
I don't know. The people at the Royal Exchange, as in touch now as we were in 1571 when we were opened by Queen Elizabeth I. Anyway, that's why it was the prototype for all office buildings and all shopping centres. So that's why I'm saying that the Royal Exchange ruined Britain.
There you go. But has it ruined Nat's chances of winning today? That's my link.
Let's find out.
You can vote. If you go online, you can go to twitter.com/date_fight.
If you go to Facebook, you can go to facebook.com/datefight.
Yes, and you can vote, and we will decide the winner on Sunday. We won't decide it. You'll decide the winner.
You will decide it.
We'll announce it on Sunday, yes. Also, I put my forfeits up on social media. You can have a look at that. So anyway.
Have a look at that. It's made it all worthwhile.
Yes.
79 episodes, and it suddenly is all paying off.
Yes. That's it from us for today. I need to go fairly abruptly, as there's a quite substantial jar of mustard that needs to get put in the fridge. We will see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye.